But first, a Michigan congressman has just been named co-chair of the House Automotive Caucus. Congressman Gary Peters, Democrat from the 14th District, will co-chair the caucus with Republican Congressman John Campbell, who, it should be noted, was once a car dealer. He's from California. Congressman Peters joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Cynthia.
Well, the idea of this bipartisan House Automotive Caucus, it sounds very, very impressive. What can the caucus really do for the domestic auto industry?
Well, I think it's important to tell the story, and that's really the focus of bringing together members. Right now, I think we're at 50 members, part of the Auto Caucus, and members all across the country. As you mentioned, my co-chair is from California, so as important as the auto industry is for Detroit, which I'm blessed to represent, and Michigan, the auto industry, of course, is important for the whole country. So it's important to have representatives from around the country. I'm one of those believers and a big believer that you can't be a great country unless you actually make something and manufacture something. And then you really can't have a manufacturing sector unless you have a strong and vibrant auto sector. So it's important to tell that story and to make sure that there's support in Congress for some of the challenges that the automotive industry faces in our country.
And does the supply base also gain access to the caucus and get on your radar?
Absolutely. In fact, that's, as you know, Cynthia, that's where most of the jobs are, actually in the supplier base, more than the big three or the other Nissan, Toyota, and others. It's all of the parts that get provided, and that's really the real engine for manufacturing as well, whether it's rubber or steel or plastic or the IT stuff, computers that are now in automobiles. It's that supply base, and that's really where all the innovation is, too. It's really the suppliers that are constantly innovating and doing some very creative things. Certainly here in Michigan, I mean, we've got a very vibrant auto supply sector that is doing cutting-edge technology. And in fact, I love telling my colleagues in Washington, D.C., every opportunity I get is that a lot of folks, because they think of Michigan and Detroit, they kind of think of smokestacks and factories, and we have those. We're proud of them. But the other thing that we're very proud of is that we have more engineers in the greater Detroit area than any other region of the country. And that's why, quite frankly, when the U.S. Patent Office, they decided to open a patent office outside of Washington, D.C. for the first time in their history. And where they put their first office for the patent office was not in Silicon Valley in California. It was in Detroit, Michigan. That's a tribute to the types of talent we have here in the area.
I'm speaking with Congressman Gary Peters, Democrat from the 14th District, who is the newly named co-chair of the House Automotive Caucus. I'm kind of curious, as you kind of look ahead and what you want to cover and what you want to have discussed in the caucus, what do you see? What are your main goals and issues that you want to focus on, both short-term and long-term, Congressman?
Well, I think you know, important thing is the innovation. We are in a very competitive environment around the world, and other countries also appreciate and understand the importance of the auto sector to their economy. And so we've got to make sure that we continue to be at the cutting edge of new developments in auto efficiencies, fuel efficiencies, performance. I'm working on a bill, the Advanced Vehicle Technology Act, which is really public-private partnerships in R&D to make sure that the best cars in the world are made in America. And we've got to find ways where the government and private industry can partner together and together their strength there. So those are the types of things that we want to build support for in Washington. But in order to build that support in Washington, we have to make sure that members of Congress understand the importance of the industry.
And with that in mind, certainly we've all, Michigan, Detroit, anyone who's involved with the auto industry, either as OEM or supply base, have traveled some long, tough miles since the automotive crisis of 2008-2010. What is the image of the U.S. car companies right now among your colleagues in Congress?
Well, it is certainly better than when I got there, but that's why we've got to continue to do that. And I think the important part is, which I mentioned earlier, is that folks understand the auto industry touches each and every district, no matter where you live in this country. And I came into Congress in 2009, right at the height of the crisis, and worked to get support for the loans that were absolutely essential to keep Chrysler and General Motors in business. And you know, I was struck by the lack of knowledge that people had, and they didn't realize the importance of the auto industry. And quite frankly, it wasn't until auto dealers started to start speaking up as to the troubles that they faced that everybody realized everybody has an auto dealer in their district, and many of them. And so we were able to get that support that was necessary, but now with a tremendous success. And what we've seen happen here in Detroit with our local producers, certainly the image has changed in Washington. And if you look at the product that's now coming out of Chrysler and General Motors and Ford, they're products that we are all very, very proud of and should be proud of. And people are really taking notice, particularly when it comes to fuel efficiency. You know, our domestic auto manufacturers are now leading their foreign competitors when it comes to fleet efficiency of cars. American ingenuity is an incredibly powerful force, and that ingenuity is alive and well in the domestic auto industry now and is really leading the recovery of the overall economy.
I want to harken back. You had mentioned a few moments ago the importance of building great cars in America. At the same time, there's no doubt the automakers are planning to add capacity in North America to meet the increasing demand, but it appears those assembly factories are going to be in Mexico. A lot of development, especially around Celaya, a lot of automakers are announcing plans to build or add to factories in Mexico. Is there anything that can be done by you and your colleagues to get those assembly jobs back to the U.S. and back to Michigan?
Well, we have to have those jobs here. That's why we have to have manufacturing policy, and that's part of what we'll be doing in the caucus, too, is to make sure that the automobiles are actually built here in this country. And that means not just the big three. And so, you know, we have folks from Honda and who represent Honda plants and Toyota plants and Nissan and BMW. To me, it doesn't matter as long as they're making them in the United States with American workers, and those are good-paying manufacturing jobs. So we've got to figure out ways to make sure that it's competitive for that to occur. One area in particular, I mentioned the Advanced Vehicle Technology Act that I'm working on, but there's also a fund, Advanced Vehicle Technology Fund, that made sure that our big companies had the access to the capital that they needed at a competitive price that would allow them to have the resources to retool their factories to make these new cutting-edge cars. And you know, for example, here in the greater Detroit area, Ford Motor Company makes a car here that is used to be made in Mexico at one of those plants you mentioned. They've actually shifted production from Mexico back to Michigan with UAW labor. So we can win that. Just because it may be manufactured in Mexico now does not mean that we can't bring those jobs back to the United States, and that's going to be a big focus. Well, we'll figure out how we can help manufacturers do what's right for our country, which is build a product here.
Meantime, we have to ask you, Congressman, it's pretty tough not to mention the word congressman without the word sequestration leaping to mind. And I'm sure you've been hearing from people all weekend as you've been home here in Michigan. And, you know, we know what happened last Friday. That deadline came and went. Can you understand the voter frustration aimed at both Congress and the White House over the inability to stop something that was supposed to be so horrible and unpalatable that no one would let it happen, and yet it did?
Yes, I can. I can understand that frustration because I share that frustration as to trying to find middle ground. It is becoming so difficult to find middle ground. And quite frankly, I was concerned about this 18 months ago when this bill passed, and I voted against it, saying that, you know, I believe you're voting for the sequestration by passing this because we're just kicking the can down and saying these things will automatically kick in, and I don't have a lot of confidence that folks are going to come to the table and find that middle ground. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. Folks are not coming to the middle. We're not doing this in a smart way. We know we have to have cuts, so we have to cut back to deal with the federal deficit. But you got to do it in a smart way, and we're not doing it in a smart way. We're cutting good programs that are critical for the future of the country and investments in the future of the country. At the same time, we're cutting other programs that, quite frankly, could be cut even more. And the fact that these cuts are occurring to the magnitude that they are will also slow down what is economic recovery, but not as robust as any of us would like. So it is frustrating to get folks together. I mean, part of it is that I've got members in Congress who don't really have elections in the general election. They're all concerned about a primary, and whoever wins the primary wins the general election because of the gerrymander of congressional districts. We see that right here in Michigan. They were badly gerrymandered by the current state legislature. And so I've got members who are worried about the far right or the far left, but right now usually the far right and Tea Party folks who are not in any mood to compromise. In fact, they are telling their members of Congress if they compromise, they will be punished for compromising. And that makes no sense in an American political system that's premised on compromise, where you've got to find middle ground and know that nobody will ever be 100% happy with what you get, but that's the way the democratic system works.
It sure will be interesting to think about what our, for example, our grandkids may read about this era when they're studying American history a generation or so down the road, won't it?
Well, yes, and hopefully they'll have something good to read. So we've got to keep working. We've got to keep the faith and try to work in a bipartisan way, and certainly that's what I'm committed to do. In fact, there is a group that we meet fairly regularly for breakfast and across the aisle and have discussions. We need to see more of that, though.
Congressman Gary Peters from the 14th District, Democrat, thank you so much. The co-chair of the House Automotive Caucus. Thanks for joining us on Stateside, Congressman.
Cynthia, always a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's an encouraging story to tell about Michigan companies. More and more companies, especially the small to medium-sized companies, are tapping into foreign markets. And that brings a dual result. They're making money and they're creating jobs. Michigan was among 11 states that posted double-digit export growth last year. The Commerce Department reports that we were number 8 when it came to exporting merchandise to foreign buyers, with $56.9 billion in 2012, and that was up 12% from the year before. What is behind this growth in Michigan? Well, we're going to find out. Who are we selling to and what are we selling? Richard Curson is the man to ask. He's the director of the East Michigan U.S. Export Assistance Center, and he joins us here in the studio. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, what would you say is behind that 12% export growth? It's nice to see Michigan like in the top 11 of the nation for something that is a very, very healthy thing.
Right, right. Well, I think it's for a few reasons. One, I think a lot of Michigan companies realize now that about 96% of the world's consumers are outside of the United States. They're really becoming more cognizant of this. Secondly, just the fact that technology makes it so much easier to communicate with buyers and sellers and importers, joint venture partners, licensees, franchisees all over the world, back and forth. That ease of communication just means that the number of opportunities is increasing around the world too.
Did we also see a real push during the Great Recession, companies saying, hey, we got to come up with some new strategies? Is that what drove maybe companies that might have not have thought of selling to foreign customers to do exactly that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Although, while that is true, we always encourage companies think also about exporting opportunities during the good times too, not just when things are going bad economically. But yes, that does drive a lot of companies to explore other opportunities for business.
And now that the worst hopefully is over and we're on an upward trend, then this is when I think I hear you say businesses can really kind of dig in and build strong foreign relations.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. The opportunities around the world for American companies and the thousands of exporters just to Michigan, it's enormous. And, the United States is just one of about 200 countries in the world. And as I said, about 96% of the world's consumers are outside of our country. So there are all kinds of opportunities that American companies and companies just here in our own state need to think about and are doing so at a much faster clip now.
So who are our major customers when we talk about foreign exports? Who's buying?
Well, for Michigan companies, mm-hmm. Canada, about 45-46% of Michigan's exports go to Canada. A lot of those are automotive parts and components.
So they might actually come back here again in vehicles.
Very much so.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Products, particularly automotive parts and components, are crossing the border multiple times. That does happen. Outside of Canada, the next largest export market for Michigan companies is Mexico, followed by China, Germany, and Saudi Arabia.
And I would suspect with Mexico, again, we're seeing automotive components and parts heading to Mexico and then coming back production inside of finished vehicles because so much assembly is happening in Mexico.
That's true. And let's keep in mind also that there is NAFTA.
There is NAFTA.
Which does make that easier, too.
So the stage was set with trade policies that allow that to happen. What are we selling to Saudi Arabia?
With Saudi Arabia, it's any variety of products. Actually, there is some automotive aftermarket products get shipped there. But Saudi Arabia also variety of manufactured goods, electronic equipment, IT equipment, pollution control, environmental technologies, parts and components, a variety of different kinds of products like that.
And as far as services, what kind of Michigan services are being exported to other countries?
Right. Well, one that I think a lot of people don't really think about is education. When students from around the world come to Ann Arbor, for example, to study at the University of Michigan, or to East Lansing to go to Michigan State, or to Detroit to go to Wayne State, mm-hmm. and then all the other colleges and universities throughout Michigan and the United States, that is an export of education services. And remember, too, that when those students come to study in Michigan, they are paying the out-of-state tuition.
That's true. So that, yeah, and we don't think of that.
Right, right. That's just one. And then you could look at legal services, accounting services, employment services, environmental consulting. So it's really a wide variety of services, and you know we don't hear that much about it, but traditionally over many years the United States has had a surplus in the exporting of services.
And I guess we need to really dig in a little more on this sense that this is not – we're not talking about the big three automakers. We're talking about small, medium-sized businesses. So you could conceivably see mom-and-pop businesses being able to take advantage of this?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, most of the companies that we work with mm-hmm. – and my office is part of the U.S. Commercial Service, part of the U.S. Department of Commerce – about 85-90% of the companies that we work with are categorized as small to medium-sized companies, meaning 500 employees or less. Mm-hmm. And we do work with big companies too, but there are many, many companies that we're working with that many people have never heard of, but quite often the folks that we're working with are very, very sophisticated when it comes to exporting and international marketing, international sales.
And where are the, are these companies spread through Michigan? Is the wealth kind of getting spread through Michigan, or are they concentrated in certain areas?
It's all over the state. Not mm-hmm. surprisingly, of course, mm-hmm. the majority of them are in the largest metropolitan areas of the state, and a fewer number as we get out into the rural areas. But that being said, yes, they are in every county in the state.
When you think of the future, what would be some of the concerns you have for Michigan trade prospects? Particularly, let's talk about the European auto market, because mm-hmm. you've got such trouble over there. You've got Fiat in trouble and Ford and Opel. They're all losing money. There's too much capacity. What impact do you think that could have on Michigan companies, particularly in the auto supply?
Well, it could create problems. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. It's a very challenging environment. That being said, it also means that Michigan companies need to look elsewhere too. And while there are opportunities in Europe, which will remain, although they may decrease mm-hmm. over time, and things are cyclical, of course, with many, many industries. And, of course, the automotive industry is not immune to that, to those cycles. But, for example, Japan, which a lot of American companies or a lot of American companies don't think that much anymore about opportunities in Japan. Yet the automotive companies there, which we all know about, mm-hmm. they are – increasing their efforts to attract American suppliers. They want to do this. And in fact, I just heard only last week from one of my colleagues at the the commercial section of the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, who asked me if we would be interested in looking at doing a matchmaking program between automotive suppliers here and end users, or OEMs, rather, in Japan. I said, absolutely. So we'll see where that goes. But that's an exciting new prospect that I think a lot of companies here just aren't thinking too much about Japan. They've been in a recession for a long time. Mm-hmm. But here's now an opportunity that could present an additional path for prosperity, for increased sales and profits away from Europe.
And what other countries, too? I had wondered. I mean, we talked about those top five, and totally understandable, Canada and Mexico and China. But what other countries a little down the road might a smart Michigan company go, hey, they should be on our radar screen?
Mm-hmm. I think countries like Malaysia, Vietnam, Indonesia, Turkey presents some great opportunities. Growth rates in those countries have been impressive, and they are interested in doing business with American companies. And, you know, the label made in the USA carries a lot of weight, and it means something. It means quality. It means integrity. And a lot of companies around the world want to carry American-made products. So while a lot of companies think about some of the larger countries, and particularly in Michigan, thinking about Canada, mm-hmm. Mexico, and some of the other larger countries too, I would urge them very seriously to consider just these three that I mentioned. There are others too, but those come to mind very quickly as countries that a lot of companies should give very serious consideration to.
Richard Curzon, the director of the East Michigan U.S. Export Assistance Center. Thanks for sharing all this information with us today on Stateside.
You're welcome.
Investing, deciding where and how to spend money. That's a major part of the decisions made by top business executives. Well, there are 70 CEOs who have come together in West Michigan, setting up a system of investment in human capital, in their future employees. They've named this effort Talent 2025. They want to see 60% of the region's workforce achieve a post-secondary degree by 2025. The president of Talent 2025 is Kevin Stotz, and he joins us from Grand Rapids. Kevin, tell us more about the mission of Talent 2025 and the problem that you're aiming to solve.
Well, you can look at it from a number of different angles. In one respect, it's sort of the skills gap. It's also an understanding that the needs of employers, the occupational demand of employers now and in the future will require a more skilled and educated workforce. And when we're already experiencing gaps in terms of levels of education and work readiness of the workforce today, that's only expected to become more significant unless employers, educators, not-for-profits, and others come together to try to solve these different issues.
Now, the goal, as we mentioned earlier, is to have 60% of the workforce with a post-secondary degree by 2025. What's the figure now, roughly?
We've actually done some work with the Upjohn Institute and looking at the occupational demand and how the jobs of today and tomorrow are becoming more sophisticated, requiring a greater level of education than what is required today or even 10 or 20 years ago. Our estimate is that 64% of all jobs in West Michigan by 2025 will require either a certificate, a two-year, four-year, or an advanced degree. So it covers the spectrum of post-secondary education. So it's not just about going to college. We really talk about post-secondary credential being invaluable for people now and going into the future.
Well, if you were to say right now in 2013, based on where you're at now, how far do you have to go to see that 60% of the workforce have that degree?
Well, and I think we would estimate that that number is about 34% today.
All right.
And then we're going to 64, so almost double.
Almost double.
So that's a big gap.
So Talent 2025 got launched almost 2 years ago, April 2010. Can you tell us some progress and some developments and some strategies perhaps that are looking promising that have been developed in these nearly 2 years?
Some of the successes that we've had so far is one, quantifying what our the enrollment and graduation rates are within the region, and knowing that the rate of those enrollments and graduations really is not going to get us to that goal on its own. So, right. So, what do we need to do to increase the rate of enrollment by helping high school students understand the value of going on to college? Likewise, on the back end, in terms of adult workforce, knowing that there's 590,000 people in West Michigan who don't have a post-secondary credential. So, that's an opportunity to upskill the adult workforce and maybe transition them into with new skills into new careers by just giving them a little bit of education or showing them opportunities within their companies to get that. And then we've had a lot of success with early childhood by identifying so the return on investment in early childhood development, both in terms of quality preschool and child care programs. We know that there's a return of $7 for every dollar invested in early childhood, because early childhood helps them be ready for kindergarten, which leads to third grade reading proficiency, which oftentimes leads to as a great barometer indicator of being college and career ready.
There are a lot of serious conversations happening around the country raising the question, are we producing too many college graduates who get those diplomas and then they can't get good grown-up mm-hmm. jobs? Do you think that's because there's not been enough dialogue between business and educators, the kind of dialogue you're trying to do now with Team 2025?
Yes, yes, absolutely. I think one of the things that employers need to do a better job of, and we've talked about this internally, is that employers need to better quantify their demand. What jobs are they needing today and forecasting for the future, quantifying that, and then providing that to educators, be it K-12 leaders or leaders in higher education. So, and that data helps educators in terms of the curriculum and program development that helps employers, but it also helps the talent, because if they're seeing where the careers are now and in the future, maybe they'll choose those occupations because they've got better information, and they're choosing those programs that's going to lead to employment rather than choosing a degree that might sound really interesting and align with my personal interests, but doesn't lead to employment. So, and we've got evidence where there's a lot of that gaps between supply and demand.
But in your goal of hoping to see that 60% achieve a post-secondary degree, you are allowing for the fact you don't need a four-year degree to be successful. There are other forms of post-secondary degrees that could lead to good jobs.
Absolutely. You make a very good point. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about being college ready. But we know, and this is true in West Michigan and across the state, and the governor's talked about this quite a bit, is that there are a lot of occupations that may require a certificate that takes 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, that leads to employment that oftentimes pays more than a degree, a four-year degree.
Their slogan is Great Talent, Great Life, West Michigan, Talent 2025. And we've been speaking with the president of Talent 2025, Kevin Stotts. Thanks for talking with us today, Kevin.
Thank you. Have a great day.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Rick Snyder's declaration that he's preparing to appoint an emergency manager to run the city of Detroit has made headlines on a national scale. But as stories are filed and headlines are written, the true impact is really resonating in the homes and the streets and the neighborhoods of Detroit, where people's lives will be touched and touched deeply by this historic change in Detroit's government. Question is, could the change be for the better or will it be for the worse? We get several views of this question today on Stateside, both from lifelong Detroiters. We begin with someone who has run for mayor of Detroit three times, against Coleman Young in 1985 and 1989, and against Dave Bing in 2009, and his name has come up again as a possible mayoral candidate. Joining us from Detroit is Tom Barrow. He's the president of the group Citizens for Detroit's Future. Welcome to Stateside, Tom.
Hi, good morning. And listen, I'm delighted to be here this morning.
Well, you've been speaking out very strongly, Tom, against appointment of any kind of an emergency manager. So tell me, what were your feelings as you heard Governor Snyder's announcement last Friday?
I have to tell you that I was probably nauseated as I listened to him talk about the city of Detroit as if it is some kind of a human dump of incompetent people who are incapable of running their own atmosphere, and that we need to have somebody to oversee us and then to lead us to the right way. And that is just so far from the reality of this. I think we're judging Detroit based upon an inept leader who clearly was beyond his abilities. And you know, look, at the fact that I ran against being in the, and the fact that 60,000 votes couldn't be recounted is not it. I do believe the election was stolen, and I'm not reluctant to say that. But it is that Detroit does have this ability to run itself. I believe the governor has contrived this whole financial emergency, and in the process, he uses the old financial tricks that I think most accountants and CPAs recognize. He bundles debt as if, because people relate to the concept of debt. And so he bundles debt that is secured by revenues. For example, your home mortgage, you didn't intend to pay your home mortgage off in a year, but neither did we intend to pay off the interceptors and the water mains running up to Ann Arbor and to Flint within a year. They're being secured by the revenues from the water department, but that's being hidden. The general fund debt is not there.
Let me ask you that this, though, Tom. When you think about life for people in homes in Detroit where streetlights aren't working and you can't get an EMS rig to your door in time or a police officer to your door in time, where things clearly are not working, what do you say to these people who say, you know what, just make the city work and we don't care how or who gets it done? Do you think by being so vocal, are you actually hurting those Detroiters who want a working city?
Not at all. Not at all. I think, on the contrary, we're making some things clear. You know, I live in the same city that they do. I actually believe that this whole streetlight thing, I think, is contrived. I think it's designed to outsource things to DTE. But notwithstanding, not having a cop come is real. Not having an EMS unit come is real. That becomes a resource allocation issue. And in my view, I think this whole thing is being contrived by and with the complicity of others who are well-meaning, you know, Detroiters who will come along and say, well, I don't care who does it as long as it gets done. Well, you need to care because this whole thing is being put in a light that makes it appear as if Detroiters are inept and incapable of doing, when in fact it's leadership. The fact that the council and the mayor you know, have disagreements and don't get along, well, that's been the way since time immemorial. But you got to have a leader. Something, you know, Detroit is lacking that. And so where resources are being improperly allocated, I want the cops to come. I want the streets swept. You know, as you recall, when I challenged Coleman Young, these were the very same things I was saying then. So it hasn't changed in that respect. But it isn't a result of a deliberate nature of doing it. It's a result of leadership and not allocating resources correctly. And I tend to disagree with this, with well-meaning Detroiters who will say, well, we don't care what color anybody is, and we don't care, well, I don't care what color they are, but you got to be a Detroiter to understand and live with it in order to understand how you have to go about fixing it. And I don't think we need the governor, because once they get here, their objective is to privatize. I think we've seen it in every urban center. That's the only place where these emergency managers come into play, as in urban centers, because they have the resources. But Belle Isle will be gone. The lighting system will be gone. The water department will ultimately be gone. They're going to transfer, garbage collection will be privatized. Everything's going to be privatized. Your city will not look anything like the city of Detroit is supposed to be today.
But is it not fair to say Detroit is set up to serve a much larger population that is no longer there, and things do have to change and have to retrench and be streamlined?
Well, it's a matter of what those code words of streamline mean. That Detroit is set up to serve a much larger population. Look, the city is 139 square miles, and certainly it had a larger population. But you cannot just ignore how it got into whatever, to the extent that there's things going on that we don't like, how it got there. When people move out of a house and you don't care who you sell it to, and then when the banks come in and they bundle bad mortgages and then they foreclose on the house and then leave the house sitting there in atrophy when the person's trying to work out the debt with them and trying to stay in their house. And then when it goes sideways and the neighborhood starts to go down, you point as if we're all incompetent and we all are incapable, when in fact what you're really pointing to, Cindy, is a leadership issue, a leadership problem. The city council, if somebody led, the city council would come on board. They would react to it. The problem is we're not being led. And so it's given the impression to outsiders and people who remember the Detroit of their youth that we are just incompetent down here, as if there's not a single capable leader and we need a messiah. We don't need a messiah. We simply need to, you got to run your own thing. If you don't run your own thing, we've seen what happens. Mr. Bing was not a Detroiter, and we saw what happened. No one followed him. And no matter what you say, and no matter how people may want to make us into the bad person, the reality is you got to have a Detroiter who leads you, who understands. No longer can you just go by the name.
Tom Barrow, do you plan to run for mayor of Detroit?
Well, the answer to that is we have a few more meetings we got to do. We'll make a decision over the next few weeks. I frankly believe we beat Mr. Bing. I believe that they manipulated it, and I saw it when I saw the seals changed on the cases. So, but we'll make that decision, Cindy, in probably the next couple few weeks. And if we do, Detroiters need to know what you're seeing now of Detroit would never be that way with a competent person, with the energy and the drive and the vision of a Detroit. I grew up here, so I have that same vision they have. I remember my Detroit, and it hurts me every time I hear somebody say something negative about it. And when I hear a governor who's never had a relationship with us contrive a financial emergency, it's contrived. I'm telling you, I've looked at the financials. I've looked at the cash flow reports. I've looked at the audit reports. It's contrived, and this is not supposed to be going on. And I think those Detroiters who are capable do realize it, and I really do applaud well-intentioned Detroiters who will say, well, we don't care, and just let them come in and do it. I really applaud them, but because their hearts are right. But they just don't know that once you let these folks in here, and once they start privatizing, and once they start doing, their emphasis is not going to be on you. It's on making money. It's on a whole different thing.
Tom Barrow, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Cindy, it's been a delight, and I'll look forward to talking to you again.
Tom Barrow is president of the group Citizens for Detroit's Future. We continue our conversation about the future of Detroit with a state-appointed emergency manager running the city. And we're joined now by Detroit Free Press politics and editor James Hill. His column in Sunday's Free Press was titled, Teamwork With and For the People Can Remake City. And James Hill joins us now. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you today, Cindy?
Good. You're a lifelong Detroiter, and I'd like to get your feelings and thoughts as you heard that announcement from Governor Snyder about an EM.
The first thought that I had was, I was sad as others here in the city were, because we tried to put faith in our elected leaders to get things done, but we've been subjected to the years and years of bickering and the back and forth with the mayor and the council, and that seems to have been an impediment to actually getting things done for the citizens. And that is what it really comes down to. I mean, the fact is someone has to look out for the citizens of the city of Detroit. When we call the police, we want the police to come. We call fire, we want fire to come. We do want our streetlights to work. We want good schools. We want job opportunities. The needs of Detroiters are no different than the needs of anyone in any other community in this state. And the question is, where's the leadership to get it done?
And looking back at the history of Detroit, and it certainly was clear that Mr. Barrow was laying a lot of the blame at the feet of Dave Bing. What are your thoughts on that? Does it not go back further and deeper and longer than the Bing administration?
Oh, yes. It goes back much further than that. I mean, the fact is we've had leaders in place for decades who were charged with turning things around. I mean, a part of it really comes down to, and I think where some people are, where a big part of the impediment is the fact that, you know, we do have kind of poor infrastructure here in the city. And when I say poor infrastructure, I don't just mean like roads or homes or things like that. I mean in terms of technology. There's a lot of things that we could be doing to improve the city in terms of how it functions if we had a better functioning infrastructure here in the city. I mean, if we had the capability to kind of modernize the technologies and things that we have here, I think that you would be able to have a more responsive government because you would be a little more interactive. Residents would be able to get things done simpler. You wouldn't need 10 people to do the job that one or two people can do if you just had that kind of technology in place where you could do something as simple as, you know, filing a complaint, getting a new garbage can even, you know, without having to physically go to a waste yard or whatever to try to get paperwork done. You know, these are things you should be able to do online. These are things that you can do in other communities that have better services for its residents that you don't have here in the city of Detroit. And I mean, so it goes back a lot farther, but it's more than just the people. It's also the infrastructure of the city and what we're capable of doing.
So what do you say to those like Tom Barrow who want to resist a state takeover with everything they have?
Well, I mean, the fact is everyone here has tried to resist this, emergency manager. Everyone here has tried to resist having the state come in to take over what's going on here to try to get the finances in order. And there's, you know, but there, where have been the ideas? Where have been these creative ideas for how we can change things? How can we change what we've been doing? Because obviously what we've been doing hasn't been working. I mean, we've been kicking the can down the road so long that the can's now a bottle cap. So what new ideas do you have to generate revenue? What new ideas do you have that can stop the hemorrhaging of residents here? The residents are leaving because they're not getting their services. They're paying the highest taxes in the state, but you're not getting the bang for your buck. How can we provide that bang for the buck for the residents? And this is what has failed to happen up to this point. Now, whether that is ego, whether that is political grandstanding, whether that is just a lack of understanding of what it takes to get it done, that I'm not quite sure of. But the fact is, these things have been a problem for decades, and we need to figure out that problem, and we need to solve that problem because, in the end, it's the residents who are suffering. I mean, this isn't a partisan issue. This isn't a black-white issue. This is a service issue, a basic human needs, basic human rights of the residents who live here and what they deserve.
And to Detroiters who would say to the folks outside of Detroit, stay in your own lane, what would you say to them?
Well, you talk about stay in your own lane as in stay out of Detroit. Mm. Well, the fact is, we need people to come into the city. We have good people here in the city with good ideas. We need to have those people step up and contribute to the conversation. I mean, oftentimes those are the people who are, as I mentioned in the column, who are browbeaten, who are talked down, who can't get their points across because maybe they say something that doesn't agree with, you know, this self-determination of Detroit. And it's like, but the fact is, the people here are hurting. The people here need someone who is going to be responsive to them, and they need to be heard. But, you know, at the same time, we also have to be willing to step up and make our voices heard. We have to be able to be a part of the conversation, and that's going to be the most important part. Look, nobody wanted us to be in this situation where we are with an emergency manager, but the fact is, this is the point we're at now. So how do we make the best of this situation now? How do we make sure that the concerns of Detroiters are heard, that the voices of the regular everyday people, not just the people who are shouting and ranting, but the voices of the everyday people who just want to be able to live a decent life, to be able to raise a family, to be able to work and have their kids go to good schools and enjoy life. How do we make sure that they are heard?
And what would you say to whomever that emergency manager is going to be? What's the first thing that EM needs to do to begin the process and win over people in Detroit?
Well, I think the first thing that they have to do is there has to be a dialogue. There has to be a dialogue with the residents and stakeholders in the city of Detroit. I mean, they have to feel that they are a part of the process and that this is not just something that's being forced upon them and this is what's going to happen and this is what we're going to do. And, you know, to whatever you have to say, whatever. You have to have a concern for the city of Detroit. You have to have an understanding of the city of Detroit. And so if you can come in, rather that is having someone come in and that forces our elected leaders, if they are still a part of this process, to actually sit down, set aside the differences, and work together to come up with a plan to get us out of this, then fine. That is a win. That is a win. If you can come in and show that, hey, okay, we're going to put in the first 2-3 months of this happening, you know, residents here are seeing more police on the streets. Residents here are seeing police or ambulances respond. Street lights are coming on. If you can do a few of these things, some of the low-hanging fruit, the things that people just need to see that are part of everyday quality of life things, making sure the trash is picked up on time, you know, that their government is being responsive to them. If you can come in and in those first few months make some of those tangible fixes that people can see, then maybe we get some buy-in. Maybe we get, again, if our own elected leaders are a part of this process, maybe they start to work together. That is the hope. We don't know if that's going to be how it goes, but I'm certainly trying to be hopeful and optimistic that this is going to bring everybody to the table with the ideas, not just the yays and nays, but some real thoughtful ideas of how we can turn this around and how we can make this better for the people who live here.
James Hill, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Have a good day.
James Hill is the politics editor for the Detroit Free Press.